Let's begin this morning with a visualization. Just taking a comfortable posture.
If you put the mic in the middle, because when you turn to the right, your voice doesn't get into the mic.
Yeah, it's part of the problem with these kind of mics. No matter what we do, that as we move our heads, they're not gonna. But I'll take your. I'll accept your criticism. So, the visualization I want to offer you. So, just closing your eyes. Is being offered not so much as a practice that you will necessarily repeat after today, but it's offered as something that is more instructive, illustrative of the mindfulness practice. So, using your imagination to orient yourself in a forest. Getting a sense of the quiet and solitude of that location. And imagine that there is a one-room house, like a shack. And then locate yourself inside this one room cottage or shack. And now you notice that this one room cottage has 5 windows and 1 door. And the 5 windows represent your 5 senses, the ones that we conventionally talk about, of hearing and seeing and smelling and tasting, and of body sensations, which include the sensations that are emotional in their origin. And then in Buddhism, we have a 6th sense, which is the mind. And so the door represents the mind. And in each of the windows and through the door, you see all kinds of interesting activities, sights, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts. Now, in the middle of this cottage, with the 5 windows and the 1 door, there is a chair, and it's an easy chair. And it's an easy chair because of the sense of ease that you feel when you take the seat. This chair is imbued with such a deep sense of ease that you wonder if there's not some magic involved in it or some healing quality to it. It's an incredibly comfortable chair. But the chair comes with 2 instructions. To retain your ease, it requires you to be somewhat vigilant about an awareness of what's going on in the 5 windows and the 1 open door. The other requirement is that you don't get involved. So as long as there's a vigilant awareness of what's happening through the windows and through the door, and you resist the temptation to get involved, you get to retain your sense of ease in the easy chair in the center of this room. This, of course, is a metaphor for the mindfulness experience. You could imagine, for example, the door having a river that runs just outside of it. That river runs from right to left. And all kinds of boats will kind of flow through your awareness as you look through the door. Some rowboats, speed boats, a booze cruise, a dinghy, all kinds of interesting things. And the temptation, of course, is to run out and get on the boats, and we have that experience over and over again where we end up on one of the boats and we're a couple miles down and then we recognize that we've lost our sense of ease. And so we have to climb back onto the shore and hike back and then get back in the chair. And so that's part of the process. And so the question becomes, what is it that you become willing to give up your sense of ease for? And so we watch this in ourselves. Our ease dependent upon vigilant awareness of what's arising and passing in the present moment, through the senses, in our mind, emotionally, body sensations. And to the degree that we maintain objective awareness, and we don't get involved, we are able to maintain this sense of ease. A couple of ways that we give up our ease on retreat may be getting lost in the desire for sensual pleasures, or getting involved in what arises in the windows. And so the mind states of desire for sensual pleasure arise, and we give up our ease and we pursue them. And so we go through one of the windows. Another way that we may give up our ease on retreat or even in life is when someone comes and knocks on the door and there's somebody who is someone we're holding resentment for. And so we give up our ease and we walk to the door and we meet them. And often we do so with violence and unskillful speech. And we're lost, our ease is lost. So this is the question of this descriptive or illustrative visualization is, what are you willing to give up your sense of ease for? And so I offer that to you as a contemplation today and the rest of the week. When you're ready, opening your eyes and coming back into the room. So what we're doing, if it's not obvious already, is that we are we're operating from a perspective or a system of instructions basically based on the four foundations of mindfulness, which are the instructions that the Buddha gave on where to place our attention so that we can have an experience that approximates the type of awakening that the Buddha had. And so we began earlier in the week by zooming our awareness into a category of experience, that is the sensations associated with breathing, both as a means of, as Noah said, gathering our attention or developing concentration, and also acknowledging that the breath can be a vehicle to insight in and of itself, that we can see impermanence, we can see the impersonal nature of the breath, that, that this body breathes itself, that it's not, we're not doing it. There's a whole host of insights that are available when we simply pay attention to the breath. There are entire schools of Buddhist practice that focus entirely on the breath and consider it a vehicle to full liberation. And then yesterday, Vinny took that sort of zoom in focus and opened it up a little bit. And now we've included the entire body and all of its sensations, including those which have an emotional origin. We start to notice that our emotions manifest as physical sensations in the body. And if we just spent the whole rest of the retreat in our bodies, there would be limitless insights available to us. And it's the reason why the body is actually the first foundation of mindfulness, that it is truly a foundation. In my view, it's a foundation on which all of the other foundations are built upon. It anchors us. Part of the reason we start in the body is because, I should say one of the benefits maybe, is that it begins with what we start to notice when we place our attention on the breath or in the body, is that we start to notice that the mind doesn't stay, that we have a kind of a compulsive or addictive almost relationship. This is the way Noah has characterized it for many years, and kind of talking about we begin to break our addiction to identification with the thinking mind. And so it's quite important that we get out of the mind and we spend a couple of days on retreat in the breath, in the body. Today, we're going to expand the instructions now to actually include the mind. So this is an interesting idea, right? Mindfulness of the mind. What is that? I'd like to kind of conjure up again that image that I offered on the first night of our subjective experience being like a six-piece sort of chamber orchestra. Sights and sounds, much like the cottage metaphor or illustration, that there's sights and sounds and tastes and smells and body sensations and the objects or content of the mind. And that our awareness is actually something, is a seventh thing. It's something that is separate from the contents of the mind. So in the same way that we can direct our attention, our awareness, our mindfulness down into sensations associated with breath or to the extreme bottoms of our feet in the walking meditation, we can actually take that awareness and turn it on the mind itself. I like the definition that I heard many years ago from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who says that mindfulness, his definition of mindfulness was that that mindfulness was an objective. I think he actually used the word detached. I use the word objective because I think detached is a little sticky, because what it suggests is that we're not actually connected to, or it can suggest that we're not quite connected. It's a sort of, we're not actually in it. But detachment is helpful because it suggests that there's a kind of an objective quality that we can cultivate in relationship to whatever's happening. And so the definition he uses is, it's an objective or detached observation of what's happening within us and around us in the present moment. And so I think that piece of, I like that piece of, or I like the definition because of the centrality of that objectivity or detachment. And again, mindfulness is not an avoidance, it's not turning away. In fact, it's the precise opposite. But it does have a quality of space. We're not lost in. We're not fully identified. We're not incarnated into whatever's happening. We aren't anger. We aren't lust. We aren't sadness. We have a body and a mind and a heart that experiences these things. And we can have a sort of objective relationship to them. So today, we expand the instructions to include the mind. And I'd like to do it in three ways. First, we will do I want to talk about the mind in terms of mind states. These are states of mind. In a way, even there, I like the fact that we're grounded in the body already, because sometimes these, what we regard as or talk about as mind states, have a component or a manifestation in the body itself as well. So already here we start to see that there's not really a separation between the mind and the body, that they influence one another, that we can conjure an image in the body or we can have a mind state that manifests as contractions or sensations in the body. And in a way, we were just talking about this the other day, it's kind of a false separation. It's understood in Buddhism that often when the Buddha would say the mind, that actually it was something more like the heart mind or the body mind, that there really is no actual separation. But it's useful for us to practice in this way. So first, we'll talk about mind states, and particularly with a focus on how to discern wholesome and unwholesome ones. So that's one way I like to do it. The second way is to explore these, actually with that as a framework, those mind states in terms of what we call hindrances. Every retreat that ever happens in the Western Vipassana world has a talk on these hindrances, because they're important to know about, because they, as the name implies, hinders our capacity to be present, to develop mindfulness and concentration. And the third way that I want to do it, and I'll mostly do this in the instructions, the sitting that we'll do in a few, to turn our attention on the mind in terms of exploring thoughts themselves. So we have a little work to do. Okay. So mind states, and I mentioned that we would do so in terms of looking at wholesome or unwholesome. Like, we hear these words, wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful. Even when we look at the Eightfold Path, there's this sort of right view, right intention, right action. And I feel like I wanted to just say a couple of words about that, because I think when I reflect, maybe it's sort of my own personal conditioning as a gay man, sort of having lived in a culture that views us as immoral, like our actions are immoral, or we're sinful. And sometimes when I start to hear that language, I have a kind of contraction, that there's a reaction that I have to it. And when I started to recognize that that the criteria for how we discern whether or not a mind state or an action or our speech is skillful or unskillful or wholesome or unwholesome has to do with the basic two values that we have in Buddhism, which maybe actually collapse into one thing, which is suffering. But the two aspects of that maybe are one, that we want to look at our actions or our speech or our mind states or our thoughts or our intentions because they have the potential to cause harm. So they become labeled as unwholesome or unskillful if the outcome or they set up the conditions to cause harm or for us to suffer. And that's the other piece, is just self-generated suffering. The whole Buddhist path, the Buddha's famously said that he basically teaches two things. He teaches suffering and its end. And so part of when we talk about suffering, it's important to understand what we actually mean by that. And I'll talk a bit about it probably in the body of the talk. But just so you know that these ideas of right or wholesome or skillful have to do with creating the appropriate conditions for us to have this awakening experience. It's not the same kind of condemning, moral sort of experience that might come from, that I feel like is prominent in our culture and some of the other religious traditions, that it really is about creating the conditions so we don't cause harm to ourselves, to others, that we don't suffer. We don't self-generate suffering out of our relationship to life on life's terms as it unfolds. I want to read the directions from the Foundations of Mindfulness, this foundation on the mind. The Buddha always starts these sections by basically giving us a rhetorical question, which he then answers. But the rhetorical question in this case is, how then does one abide contemplating the mind in terms of mind states? And the answer, my friends, is the practitioner knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. The practitioner knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. And the practitioner knows a deluded mind to be the deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. So, a couple of things happen there. One, we're told what kinds of mind states to look at. So we're looking at lust, to use the terms of this translation, lust, anger, delusion. And we hear, for those of you who hang around Buddhist circles long enough, you start to hear this sort of repeated idea that, I think Against the Stream even had a t-shirt once that said, against greed, hatred, and delusion, or lust, anger, ignorance. There's a lot of different ways to talk about it. So that's the first thing that happens in that. The first, it was basically two instructions, is to know that these are the three mind states that we're interested in. Second thing that happens is that we're given instructions on what to do with them or what to know about them. And it's interesting that they're quite simple instructions, actually. The first instruction is to know when they're present. So knowing that a lustful mind is a lustful mind, to know it as such, to know an angry mind as an angry mind, simply to know it as such. Knowing a deluded mind is a little bit more complicated, probably, because one might wonder, well, if you're deluded, how do you know you're deluded? And we'll talk about that. When we're on retreat, and actually in the rest of our lives, but when we're on retreat, and what I, you know, as you read further into the sutta and you read the commentaries and I've talked to my teachers and read a lot about this, it seems to me that what is mostly being pointed to when we talk about a lustful mind has to do with it's really the movement of the mind to away from what is uncomfortable, what is painful, what is not preferable to us in our experience towards pleasure or even numbing. And typically the vehicle that we use to do this is sensual pleasure. The way that you might experience that on retreat is to be sitting with some discomfort and then notice that your mind will move to something as simple as, you know, going in the kitchen and getting one of the rice cakes and almond butter, something like that. A cup of tea with as much honey as you can squeeze out of that little bear head. You know, that we see this movement away from what we're actually sitting with. And the misconception that people come into retreat with, obviously, is that, you know, I'm going to come to retreat and I'm going to calm my mind and I'm going to get zen and it's going to be all good. And then when you sit down, you recognize that this is the beginning of unlocking a whole lifetime of history. That what we touch actually is our abandonments and our social oppression and our grief and our loss and our sadness. That what happens is that we see life is not all good. It's a balance. It's both. And the Buddha's teachings started by pointing out that there is this thing that is often translated quite simply as suffering. That word dukkha that is translated as suffering means a lot more than that. But the reality is that what we touch into when we really look at our lives is this sort of sense of I was thinking that this became very clear for me when I experienced death for the first time. When my mother died when I was 19 of cancer, she was diagnosed with cancer. And she had that pancreatic cancer that, I don't know if some of you are old enough to remember Michael Landon, the TV actor from Little House on the Prairie. He died rather publicly of this pancreatic cancer, and so it was already in the news a lot of how what a vicious kind of cancer this was and how quickly typically people, it was the one that you don't get rid of. And in that same period of time, one of my good friends from back home, I had just graduated high school, was killed in a bus accident. And it became very clear to me, that was sort of like the end of my ignorance or innocence about life. And there was a big conditioning that happened there for me, and it was very painful to sort of realize that you could be 17 or 65, and for me to experience that, the kind of fundamental unreliability that those people will actually be there the next day, right? And so the Buddha, in his first teaching, points directly at this. He says, dukkha is defined as birth, aging, sickness, death. It goes just right into the heart of it. Right? He also said that it's not getting what we want. It's being separated from those things or those people that we find to be pleasant, that bring us security and comfort. And it's the daily kind of experience of just having to contend with what is unpleasant in our experience. And that teaching comes with a prompt. And the prompt is one of action. The Four Noble Truths actually are not dogmatic sort of assertions that are to be believed because some enlightened being a long time ago said you should believe them. They're actually prompts to action. We have to do something with them. And what we have to do with them is fully know them, fully know birth, aging, sickness, death, fully know not getting what we want, fully know the experience of being separated from what brings us comfort or love. I know that some of you are sitting in this retreat right now, partly because I've talked to you about it, with just the basic feeling of being separated from the people back home, those that you love and that bring you comfort and that you lean on, that you're having the experience right now of just that separation. So that's available to us as we sit down. And so the movement of the mind is very often to not be with that. And the form that has taken, and definitely in a big way in my life, has been the movement towards pleasure. And so that becomes a problem, because if our happiness or our ease in life is somehow, we think that it's dependent upon manipulating external circumstances or acquiring something from outside ourselves in terms of sensual pleasure, then we have a problem. Because that's an aspect of delusion right there. We start to talk about how we define delusion. We can't actually satisfy ourselves in that way. And if you think about, if you explore the gratification process of just the desire and the pursuit and then the actual acquisition and gratification of sensual pleasure, the reality is we don't have much to show for it. And it's a painful process. Now, I also want to say, as a balance to all of that, that the message that we don't want you to take home is that sensual pleasure is bad, that desire is bad, that pleasure is bad. Ice cream is not bad. Sex is not bad. Pleasure is actually not the problem. I'm hearing a sigh of relief from my teacher. Sensual pleasure is actually not the problem. It's our relationship to it. It's how we use it. So part of this discerning of whether it's wholesome or unwholesome has to do with whether we are using it as an avoidance. One of my clients recently said he goes, because I work with people around addiction, and I work with people and with food and diet and lifestyle. In this particular case, I was working with someone who has a kind of food addiction history, and he was saying, he says, addiction is the exact opposite of fully knowing dukkha, because it's completely a different approach, right? It's not turning towards a fully knowing. When we use it as an avoidance, then it's a problem. And it's where harm arises. It's where we put ourselves to sleep. I had an experience a number of years ago, you know, in terms of illustrating this idea of what we're to do with it, to fully know, to know a lustful mind as a lustful mind, or to know a mind without lust as a mind without lust. A number of years ago, it might have been one of my very first Against the Stream retreats. It was at Spirit Rock. It was probably 7 or 8 years ago. It happened to line up with San Francisco's Gay Pride Festival. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to San Francisco's Gay Pride Festival or not, but the majority of my experience with Pride festivals, I lived in New York for a long time, and for whatever reason, I didn't have the same experience in New York, and I didn't tend to go to them very often. But when I was younger and just had come out and I was in San Diego, I have to tell you that San Francisco's Gay Pride Festival makes San Diego's Gay Pride Festival look like a walk through the mall with Mr. Rogers. Maybe like Mr. Rogers, if you can imagine him in chaps. Which you've now just done. But for me at the time, single at the time, the reality of, there's all kinds of great things that happen at Pride, but it's pretty much a lust fest. I mean, there's like thousands of super hot men walking around shirtless, all looking to get laid. You know, it's like, it's a really super intense experience. And, it's part of the fun. And it's not bad. But I had the experience of just being super stimulated by lust, and I actually that weekend was the first time that I ever ended up in a scenario or a party where like sexually explicit things were happening at the party itself, and never kind of seen that. And I was at once completely like titillated by it and also completely disturbed by it. And it was just a very kind of, but it was pretty wild to be in an environment like that for the first time, where there was basically an orgy in the basement. And the very next day, on Monday, I think our retreat started, I here I am sitting in retreat, like this. And completely replaying that cute boy from the corner of Divisadero, and you know, just sort of like everything that had happened. And I spent like the first day and a half just in total sexual fantasy. And then I started to kind of get the point that that it was enough to actually label the fantasies. And when I started to sort of, I think of this as like one of the metaphors I give is like skeet shooting. Like, you know, like you get, like the mind kind of fires up an image and you just kind of, pew, I see you, Mara, you know? Or it's like whack-a-mole, you know, you're just like, no, I see you, I see you, I see you, I see you. And what happened is that the first day and a half of my experience, my retreat, was like knowing the mind as a lustful mind. But in the labeling it of it, in meeting it with mindfulness, it decreased and disappeared. And I actually spent 5 days with an experience of like, wow, when I'm not actually feeding my sexual energy in any way, it actually dissipates to a point which actually almost scared me. I'm like, what's going on? I'm so identified, you know, at the time with the sexual energy. Even now, sometimes. So I had the experience of knowing a mind as a mind without lust as well. That's important because knowing the conditions of a mind that is without lust is, those are the optimal conditions for concentration and mindfulness. So I think the reason that we're asked to know that experience is so that we familiarize ourselves with a mind that's optimally situated to develop concentration and mindfulness. The other mind states, of course, is anger. We spent a lot of time talking about it last night. I think George illustrated quite beautifully the downside to anger and resentment. And this is a category. It involves anger, resentment, ill will of all shapes and sizes, all stripes. I had a similar experience at Spirit Rock where a few years ago on a month-long retreat where I had just started working at the Trevor Project. And for those of you who don't know, the Trevor Project is a suicide prevention and crisis intervention line for gay youth. And so we take calls from kids who are 12 to, you know, up to early 20s who are calling because they're in crisis around social oppression, many of them with suicidal ideology. And we were practicing at Spirit Rock that week, as we do here. In the afternoons, we were practicing some of the heart practices, and forgiveness, I think, is what we were working on. And I remember I found it easy to forgive my dad for the things he said, or my brother for his unskillful. But I had a really hard time working with things like societal oppression. Like, how do you forgive something that's so, like a society that's so permeated with hatred for who you are. And to the point where I see the results of that hatred are young people who actually are so far beyond their capacity to receive the hate that they want to kill themselves. And to sit in that, I was so angry. And I was even angry at the proposition that I could even forgive that. You know, and it was the beginning of the conversation that we were having here in California around Proposition 8. It was incredibly painful. At some point in the process, I mean, I had a process with the teachers, and I even kind of in the middle of this retreat kind of made a little bit of a scene. kind of bringing some presence to that. Partly because I didn't even trust the Buddhist establishment, because I knew that in the Buddhist establishment there were senior teachers who were gay men or women who didn't ever talk about their experience. I felt very isolated in what to do, how to even use Buddhism or use these practices as to heal myself. What I noticed is that as I got underneath the anger, that what was underneath it actually was pain and sadness. And that the anger dissipated when I actually touched into and attended to my own sadness. You know, my own sadness of being disowned by my father when I came out. My own sadness of walking to every room, wondering whether it's safe or not, all my life. The sadness of these kids wanting to kill themselves. And I found that that's actually where the action is. I think that, I don't know that I totally believe that anger is secondary, but it seems to me that pretty much whenever anger is present, if we can drop one level underneath it and touch into our sadness and our hurt and our fear, that there is some way in which that we can actually begin to heal ourselves. And what happens actually is that the anger itself dissipates because we're getting to the core of what actually needs our attention. Now, so we have this idea of lust and we have this idea of anger as mind states which are problematic. We're hearing that proposition or that assertion. So why are they problematic? One of the main reasons, if we go back to this kind of value system of not causing suffering for ourselves, not causing harm to ourselves or to others, that when we start to recognize that our thoughts and our intentions precede our speech and our actions, and that it's our speech and our actions which bring results. Now this begins to touch into what I hold in my experience as maybe one of the primary foundational concepts in Buddhism. It's been so important to me to understand it. And in fact, it was one of the things that the Buddha said, that if you knew this, or you saw this concept, you saw all of Buddhism, all of the Dharma. And if you saw the Dharma, all you saw actually was this concept. And the concept is basically what is known as causality or cause and effect. And for those of you who sit with me, I talk about it all the time. I think it's applied in so many ways in the Dharma. And it basically means that nothing that we can experience physically, emotionally, otherwise, is experienceable without its causes. So that was a really sloppy way of putting that. Let me say that again. Anything that can be experienced only dependent upon its causes. The opposite way of saying that is nothing that exists, exists independent of its causes. So this means, like, if you just contemplate the fact that your bodies are here, they're here because your parents got together. It's very easy to look around the physical world and understand that everything exists because of its causes. Even our bodies are maintained by the food that we eat, and that food exists only because of sun and soil and water. That everything has there's a cause and effect relationship between everything. So this is, we see the application of this in the teachings on karma, that our actions bring results. And since we're interested in results that are more happiness and ease and well-being and balance than we are that which is harm and suffering and a lack of well-being, then we understand that those outcomes depend upon their causes. And the types of causes that we talk about are basically our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. And thought itself can cause harm. We've all experienced our ways of holding our experience, our ways of thinking about ourselves, our ways of thinking about an experience that cause suffering. But our thoughts and our intentions precede our actions. So, and I think this is illustrated beautifully in the opening lines of probably the most famous collection of teachings in Buddhism, a collection of teachings called the Dhammapada. The opening lines of the Dhammapada go something like this, depending on the translation, of course. All experience is led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with an unwholesome mind, and suffering will follow. What's it? Suffering will follow just like the wheel of the cart follows the heel of the ox that pulls it. It's a beautiful image. And then he goes on to say, second line is, speak or act with a wholesome mind, and happiness will follow like a never-departing shadow. So a number of things happen there. First, we see the relationship between speech and action and suffering. Right? There's a correlation between what we say, what we do in the world, and harm and suffering. But that what precedes speech and action in that chain of causal chain of events is an unwholesome mind. So then we go right back to that sort of criteria that we have for determining whether a mind state or a thought is wholesome or unwholesome. Simply is that it causes suffering or it causes harm. So when we are operating from, I think this is why that these specific mind states are isolated of lust and anger and delusion. We know that something like anger is a pretty terrible fuel for speech and action. Whenever we speak out of anger or resentment or ill will, that's pretty much the time when we cause harm in a relationship. I have to live with a kind of karma of having been unskillful in my speech with one of my best friends, who as a result I haven't talked to in many years. And there's a long story and a long history, and there was a lot that led up to it. But there was a single moment where I was over capacity to hold my frustration with her, and I said some things that were unkind. And I haven't spoken to her since. And I spoke from this mind state of anger and ill will. And it ended the relationship. And that's been a great suffering for me and a great harm to her. And I may or may not have to live with that for the rest of my life. So it was very powerful, that moment. So I'd like to make this sort of transition from mind states into the hindrances. And I think this can be done in actually quite a simple way. And I'm looking at the time. As is typical, I tend to go long. I think that actually the framework of these three mind states fits quite nicely with the five hindrances. So the next part of this exploration is simply about what hinders our capacity to be present. The reason we care about the hindrances is because they take us out of, it's what's implied in the name, they hinder our capacity to be present. The five hindrances are the desire for sensual pleasure, imagine that, ill will, anger, resentment, which we've touched into. The next two feel to me, I experience them as two sides of the same coin, maybe. One is the experience of sleepiness and heaviness or drowsiness that we experience on retreat. The other is restlessness, anxiety, worry, paranoia, blame, like that sort of. I mean, these can all be taken maybe as categories of experience rather than particular, maybe just not just one thing. And you find this a lot actually in Buddhism, that we'll have a term in Pali that in English we have to translate to mean many things. We have to use many words to translate it. The fifth hindrance is doubt. And it has to do with doubting, maybe on one hand, the efficacy of the practice. So many of you have probably experienced that, or your capacity to actually do it. The The Buddha asked us to do 5 things with these. So I'll just tell you what the practice is that was prescribed. Just like mind states, the hindrances, he asked us to do the same 2 things, to know when the hindrance is present, to know what it's like, what the experience of being without it is like. And then we get into another application of cause and effect or causality when he starts to say, part of the exploration is to understand what it is that has brought this experience into being. What are the conditions for the arising of the hindrance? What are the conditions, or what do we do to get rid of it? And how do we keep it from arising in the future? So I don't have nearly the time to go into all of it. But know that like part of what was being asked of us is to be present for the experience, but also to know what it's like to not have the experience present as the optimum conditions, to know that as the optimum conditions for doing the practice, the meditative practice particularly. So I'd start to get some sense of what is it that brings the desire for sense pleasure into being? What is it that brings anger and resentment into being? What is it that brings restlessness and sleepiness or heaviness or drowsiness into being? How do we understand the conditions? Can we explore the conditions that bring these experiences into being? What is it that we have to work with to get rid of them? So we've talked a lot about sensual pleasure. We've talked a lot about anger and resentment. Sleepiness, heaviness, drowsiness. I want you to know, I've never had a retreat that I've sat on where the first 1.5 days wasn't spent in that hindrance. So I just want to come out of the gate and normalize it completely. For those of you who are, I think that by now, my experience is that hopefully you're starting to experience it less, or you're free of it for the most part. It is completely normal part of the retreat process. It's quite skillful to rest sometimes. This is the opposite of maybe George's instructions to bear down. I remember being on retreat and just being like, man, I just can't stay awake. And having the teacher say to me, just go sleep. And I almost wanted to cry that I could actually take care of myself in that way. I could just respond in a wise way to just being completely beat. Even though I'm supposed to be on retreat, bearing down, you know, that actually there's quite a space, and I've talked to some of you about this. For those of you who are just way too hard on yourselves, maybe the kindest thing that you can do is actually just to take care of yourself and let yourself sleep in one day. Sleepiness, drowsiness can have... I think that sometimes one of the things I want to look at is my lifestyle. There's a lot of ways in which I have set aside particularly items, the things that I consume, because they end up resulting in drowsiness. So I don't eat wheat or sugar for the most part. I've made that as a choice, both in terms of just not wanting to be numb to my life, but also taking that kind of that prompt of fully knowing dukkha and suffering, that I've made that choice to just sort of try to really be present. I've also done that around sexuality, drugs and alcohol. There's a lot of things that I set aside so that I can actually be fully present. There's also a way in which I think that drowsiness or sleepiness sometimes is an avoidance. So sometimes, even when I'm like sober and not eating and not disappearing, losing myself in sex or the pursuit of sex or whatever, that I the last ditch is just to go to sleep. Like, I just don't want to be there, and I still see that kind of arising in me. So just to be aware of that. What you want to do if you're sleepy is you want to arouse energy. So you can stand. You're welcome to stand at any point here. You're welcome to um, One of the things I do, thank you. One of the things that I do is I actually will open my eyes and just kind of take in some light. So just basically whatever it is that arouses energy for you. Restlessness is the opposite side of that same coin. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Some can be in our diet and lifestyle. Some can be connected to our resistance to the present moment. Sometimes when we sit down and we don't want to touch into what's present, we become restless. I know I've talked to some of you about that already. We just don't want to be there, and so that manifests as bodily restlessness. Sometimes it's also, I think, connected to our ethical conduct in the world. That part of our restlessness sometimes when we sit down has to do with that we're not blameless, that there's remorse, that there's paranoia, and that manifests as a kind of restlessness in our bodies. I remember Jack Kornfield one time saying, you know, try to meditate after a day of, like, raping and stealing and talking shit to your partner, and, you know, and then sit down and actually try to concentrate. It doesn't work. So there's that correlation between sort of our ethical conduct. And George illustrated that beautifully in his sort of the way that he laid out his system that starts with a decision and then moves into generosity and progresses into ethics and then progresses into forgiveness and then the Brahma Viharas and then insight. That his, from his view, as I'm understanding it, that there are all of these, you know, there's a system of optimizing the conditions to actually be able to practice in that way. Finally, doubt. One of the ways to counter restlessness is concentration. To just really be with, go back to the breath, let it calm you. Concentrate. The last of the hindrances is doubt. And doubt has to do with doubting our, like I said, the efficacy of the practice. Does this shit work? Can I do it? And that has been my experience. And I would say, especially in a room like this, this may not sound as humble as I'd like to be, but even for me, as I sit here, and when my doubts arise, one of the things that I reflect on are the stories of the people in the community, particularly the people who are my colleagues. When I think of Noah's story, it's obvious to me that this shit works. And we have to be patient. I know that, and part of that confidence, I think that doubt is just basically the obvious opposite of confidence. And I think confidence is why we take refuge. So we have to have some sense of what the practice is actually proposing. It's good to be in a community of practitioners so we can see other people making progress. I see it all the time. I'm always inspired by the people around me and who are practicing and the students because I see the progress happens. So if I can help you in any way by saying that I'm inspired by the practice, it's facilitated incredible change in me and the people around me. I know that it works. Hopefully that's helpful. But you do have to kind of, whatever the problems are, you have to sort of resolve them and get back to some level of confidence. And that may mean addressing your doubts in your interviews, asking questions for the teachers, and outside, you know, reading and really solidifying your understanding of the practices. The hindrances, again, are not necessarily problems. They are problems when we incarnate or identify with them. Well, one thing one direction that I'll give you that you can say about all of them is that the moment that you turn mindfulness on them and know them, they cease to be a hindrance. It is only when we are identified with them that we're lost in them, that we've incarnated into them, we've become them, that it's a problem, that it's a hindrance, because we're gone. We're in sensual pleasure. We're in the kitchen eating or drinking. We're at the orgy. We are, recounting the resentful argument that we're having with somebody in our life, and we're not present. However, when we fall into that objective, detached mindfulness of the experience, we are. So that's the subtle flip that's always available to us. It's the difference between being lost in an experience and knowing it. So that's the main instruction, is to trust mindfulness. The minute we are mindful of an experience, of a hindrance, it ceases to become one, and it becomes an object available for insight. The last piece is something that I would like to do with the meditation instructions. And what I'd like to do is explore thoughts themselves. And I'll do this by offering a version of a practice that comes from George and I's teacher, and some of you will have studied with Shinzen Young. And it's basically, this was a profoundly important realization for me to have, that basically our thoughts come in they have two aspects. Basically, our thoughts are words, come as words, and they come as images. And there's ultimately an interplay between them. And each of these experiences have spatial locations in our experience that we can touch. George gave us some instructions last night, and I'd like to revisit those. And that's what we'll do for the meditation today, is we'll explore thoughts by touching into establishing some awareness of the domains in which they exist, and a process of labeling them. So let's do that.